So we have one more speaker this evening, the much beloved Vicki Robin, who lives across the water in Whidbey. I think she's most famous for Your Money or Your Life. And then more newly, Blessing the Hands That Feed Us. And looking forward to hearing from you now, Vicki. Welcome.
Hello.
Pitiful to have a stand-up comedian right after Michael. This is really pitiful.
Is it working?
Yeah, okay. So what I'm going to talk about this afternoon, this morning I did money, to this afternoon I'm doing food. And I think if there's a theme on our panel, it's bringing it down to earth. It's like practical, how do we get down into the guts of the changes that we're trying to make out of the systemic theories that are very beautiful, but it's, you know, to use an agricultural metaphor, does it hoe corn? So, my story is, I became, after, so those of us who heard me today, after I was deeply disappointed that Your Money, Your Life, by the year 2000, had not succeeded in changing everything, and going through many personal changes, I encountered a book by Richard Heinberg called The Party's Over. And I thought, that is it. I found my new cool thing called relocalization. You know, I called relocalization like Your Money, Your Life, sort of a system for changing yourself personally at a community level. You know, we're going to do this. We're going to analyze resource flows through our community. We're going to get together. We're going to change things. We can do it. Very excited about it. We started one of the first transition groups on Whidbey Island in the United States. And so we organized these things called potlucks with a purpose, which was once a month we had a potluck. People brought food. And we would have a speaker. And my goal was to have the speaker really annoy us into sort of lurching forward into our next phase of change, you know, not self-congratulatory, not things we'd already heard. So I had talked to a farmer friend, and I said, you know, could we here on Whidbey Island survive if the ferry stopped running and the bridge came down? Which seemed like a fairly reasonable question on an island. And she did a calculation, the population of Whidbey Island, 2,000 calories a day. And she said, yeah, we could certainly survive for 2 weeks in August. So I'm the kind of person who takes something like that and I build a life around it. I was like, okay, I'm going to find out about this. So sometime not too long afterwards, a farmer friend of mine, she and her husband had watched Morgan Spurlock Supersize Me, you know, Supersize Me. And she said, honey, you know, we should do Super Veggie Me. We should do, like, could 30 days, could we live just in the garden? He said, I'm not doing it. She said, I'm not doing it either. So, so she went to find somebody who was crazy enough to surrender themselves to being fed by her for a month. And after about 10 no's, she got around to me, you know, which was a perfect match because I was trying to see, can my island feed me? Let's see. And can I, you know, sort of like a food slut, you know, just about eat anything and overeat, can I eat an island diet? Can I live for a month on what she can produce? So we partnered up to do this. And I realized that I'm a meat eater, and she wasn't growing any meat on her farm. So I thought, we're going to call this the 10-mile diet, because she lives within 10 miles of my home. I'm going to draw a circle around my home of 10 miles, and I am going to be able to eat anything legal within it. Right? And you better believe, you know, I found an old hazelnut orchard. I'm crawling around in the ground trying to find hazelnuts. You know, I'm, like, doing everything to get what I need. So I go, the other thing I did is I realized I have certain foods that I am not going to live without. I am into, like, sustainability as an extreme sport, but I am not into suffering. This is so, I am going to give myself what I need, absolutely. So I gave myself four exotics, which were what? Not chocolate. There's two types of people in the world, I learned. There's chocoholics who manage their sadness by eating chocolate. And then there's crunchaholics who manage their frustration by eating nuts and crackers and potato chips. I happen to be a crunchaholic, which was difficult because I had no potato chips, I had no nuts, I had nothing. So I'm out there like I'm slicing my zucchini, which of course in the Northwest we have a lot of, and I'm making zucchini chips, you know. Anyway. So my four exotics were lemons, because I drink lemon juice every morning. I have this belief after having cancer that somehow or another I'm keeping any other cancer at bay by drinking lemon juice in the morning, which is my tip for everybody. And salt and oil. Those were my things. And I realized the next year I did the diet and I went right down to the beach. I got some water and I evaporated and I had salt. So I could have eliminated that. Then I'm like super excited to find out that they make hazelnut oil, not in my 10 miles, not even 50 miles, but if I did a 100-mile diet, I could get up to Linden where they make hazelnut oil. So anyway, long story short, so I had my four exotics, I had my 10-mile food, I went to get some chicken. Somebody told me somebody made chicken, raised chicken, and I go, like, two chickens for my month. And she said, that'll be $50. And I went, and so it was $5 a pound for the chicken. And I realized at that time that it's not, you know, it's like it took them, you know, building the pen, you know, the chicken coop and arguing with the teenage daughter to go feed them and get them water and all of the things it took to grow that chicken, that was worth $5 a pound. It's not that local food is expensive, it's why is industrial food so cheap? And then I started down that track of like, why is industrial food so cheap? And I found out a lot of food, all you're paying for is the packaging because the food is subsidized. It's like, we have to question the system. We have bread and circus. We have been given cheap food so that we stay locked into the feeding machine called the industrial food system. So I had many awakenings like that about cheese and meat and let's see, what do I want to tell you in my 15 minutes? Because I'm not planning well. So, when I first said I was going to do this 10-mile diet, somebody said, that's not a problem, just go to the grocery store. So I did go to the grocery store. And the only thing that I could find in my grocery store that was 10-mile food was honey. And this was like, now they buy some greens from a local farmer. And it was like, I am standing in the middle of 10,000 products. I love grocery shopping, by the way. Not only for the socializing, but also for buying food. And I was like, I am not living in a food system. I am living in a showroom that's the end point of an industrial food system. We think that's food, local food, because it's there. It's not. So, I mean, I went through awakening after awakening on this subject of what does it take to eat locally? And I realized I made it through the month. I lost 6 pounds. I found them again. It's not a problem. But I realized local food, I mean, we idealize that and the farmers markets and all that, and that's perfect. But local food is not a local food system. Our food system is broken. It's broken because of regulatory things. I also drink coffee and I need milk in my coffee, and I thought that was not going to be a problem because I was sure I'd seen cows someplace on my island. And apparently, I was told, it's not legal for me to buy milk from my neighbor. I was like, why? You know, like mother's milk, this is not. So food after food, I realized that part of it is the regulatory environment that has come in to keep our food supplies safe for eaters who only shop in the supermarket is inhibiting our capacity to feed ourselves. That we need scale-appropriate regulations in our communities, where if you have 2 cows or 8 goats or whatever, you can milk those animals and sell the milk over the farm gate to your neighbors. I started to see that there's a number of policies that we need to work on if we want a food system. Since then, and not because of me, but I've participated. I mean, I'm like all over my farmers. Right, Kevin? I am like so into my farmers. Since then, I have worked hard, you know, and we have something called Whidbey Island Friends of Food and Farming, and we're promoting education for business, you know, farmers to run a decent business with their farm. We have a farm school to train farmers not only to grow food in a production level, but to be able to make a business out of it. And I realized that we can all be food system change makers if we have this awakening that it's really necessary for our health. One reason, I will just say an aside, one reason I think I lost weight is that I didn't need to eat as much to feel satisfied. Number one, I didn't have that much food, and so I had to be satisfied. But number two, it's like after just eating a leg of that chicken, I was full. It was like there was more life in that. I could eat a little handful of grain like that that was grown by my friend who was a biodynamic grain farmer, and I was full. And I realized I eat a plate of white rice, or this amount. So that was another realization. Our food is de-energized. That's not a romantic notion. That is a very real thing, that our soils are degraded, and our food does not have the nourishment in it. And I started to think, is the obesity crisis because we're not pigs. Our bodies are looking for something they're not getting. So we don't have some signal that says, I'm done. So it's like I started to see just by this simple thing of being an eater in a 10-mile radius rather than a consumer in an industrial food system where there's only 3 days of food on the shelves, folks. We know this, right? Because we watch it in Houston everywhere. That's a river of food that travels through and actually travels through and out, and I actually harvest some of that food for my imaginary rabbit, you know? I get lettuce from my imaginary rabbit that are clippings off of the food that they're going to throw away. So, yeah, so we live in an industrial food system. One day in my backyard, I was standing there, I was realizing, you know, it's not only that food isn't in the grocery store. It's not only that food isn't just in my garden. I am an animal and I live in food. I am surrounded by food. All animals know how to eat from their environment. I am a dumb animal because I do not know how to turn my environment into nourishment. But that's when I got onto this idea of relational eating. And I think that's a theme for this conference too, is that it's a relational world. And it's not a transactional world, it's a relational world. And relational eating for me is becoming a local food advocate through my purchasing, through my advocacy, through talking to my congresspeople, to figuring out policies, to working for those policies, to talking to my grocer. You ask your grocer, where is that chicken from? And they have to trot back and find out where the chicken's from. And they come back, you say, well, where's the bologna from? You know, after a while, they don't want to trot back and forth. They want to know where their food is from. As shoppers, in every part of our lives, there's a question of, once you're a relational eater, you live your life such that your food system becomes healthier all around you. Not just in the quality of the food that comes out of it, but the quality of the system. That's why I call my book, Blessing the Hands That Feed Us. It's my job to do a rousing final sentence. I think I did it. It's a relational world. I'm pitiful at endings. Anyway, thank you for your attention.
This is so cool.